themselves, with and for each other, about their bodies, their rights, and their dreams. That's why I think woman-made media is so important, and why we all need to tune in to Feminist Magazine on KPFK.
Hi there, this is Sally Kirkland, and you're listening to KPFK, radio powered by the people. Fiercely independent, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Well, good afternoon, my friends. Get good up, afternoon, friends up. And listeners. You're now listening to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, and along with my co-host, Maria, we're going to bring you today's program. Maria, how are you doing?
That's a loaded question, Jim.
I know, that's why. I know. There's no secret about how we're feeling, is
there? Yeah, I mean, I am, you know, knock on wood, healthy and strong, and have a lot of really nice people around me and friends, and happy to be part of this KPFK community. And of course, you and having you as a friend as well.
Well, yes, so we're going to need that kind of friendship and solidarity, I suspect, in the period ahead, as those of us with a somewhat different point of view, shall we say, as to the guy who came elected president again last night, will need and have our work cut out for us. Well, we've got a good show, I think, today that starts off that fight back effort. Let our listeners know what they're going to hear.
Sure. Well, first, we're going to be speaking with our friend, longtime peace activist Richard Becker, on the challenges to social and economic justice that are undoubtedly coming in the next few years, if not longer, as a result of yesterday's election. And then we're going to be speaking with our friend Alvaro Huerta from Immigrant Defenders Law Center. He'll be back to talk about immigration law and policy, what that might look like starting in 2025, and what advocates here in LA and Southern California are doing right now to prepare.
Yeah, well, the issues we're covering today are certainly going to be front and center in the new Trump administration. Front and center, I suspect, in the minds of most of our listeners. So let's get right to it. We are going to start with our dear friend Richard. Well, friends, yesterday's election, of course, of Donald Trump as our next president, I think exposed a rather sad truth about where we the people are at, because there could be no doubt, really, in the minds of those who did vote for him, who did elect him, what Trump intends to do once he's back at the White House. There was no secret about it, nothing vague really about his platform. He made it clear he believes only he and other strong men, and that strong men, by the way, not strong women, should rule America. Women, indeed, in fact, too weak to rule, too silly even to know what's best for them, so he's going to, of course, protect them whether they want it or not. He believes and says openly again that he was chosen basically by the God that he claims to believe in to be our president. He says he's going to rule as a dictator, need be, and to hell with the Constitution. He intends to rid this country of millions of our immigrant sisters and brothers. We're going to be talking about that a little later in the show today. He's railed against their so-called evil blood and criminal ways and wants to make sure they no longer continue to, as he puts it, infect the Americans. He wants to reinstitute stop and frisk laws, which always, of course, target people of color to end crime. And despite all of this and more, a majority of us have voted for him to give him the chance to do exactly what he said he wants to do, what he intends to, what he's promised to do. So, yes, we're now going to have as our president an admitted authoritarian, a man who those who know him best say is a fascist. We can only wonder, with fear in our hearts and minds, what a second Trump administration will mean for the poor, for the working class, for women, for immigrants, for people of color, and for freedom of the press and freedom of speech. And we must engage in that fearful wondering in no small part, sadly, because of how many of the millions who voted for him are from those very groups of Americans who are so worried about him going after once he's elected because of what he's promised to do to them. We'll talk about how that could come to pass. So today we've invited back to the show a leading member of the truly progressive movement in America for many, many years now, to discuss what this second Trump administration, this second Trump presidency will likely mean for we the people, and how we can best mobilize to oppose its planned legislation and executive orders and other deeds and fight back against the unprecedented authoritarianism that now apparently awaits us come next January. Our guest for this is Richard Becker. Mr. Becker is the West Coast Regional Coordinator of the ANSWER Coalition, which stands for Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, a group that's put on many of the largest demonstrations of the last 10, 15 or more years in this country against war and such. He's the author of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire. And there's an update to that book that perhaps he'll tell us about. And he's the author as well of The Myth of Democracy and the Rule of the Banks. Richard Becker is also, I want to add, one of this nation's most dedicated and, I believe, effective political organizers and thinkers on behalf of peace and social and economic justice. So, Richard Becker, a warm, warm welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thanks a lot, Jim. Thanks, Maria, as well.
So, Dick, I purposely worded my introduction to this topic without really using the word fascism. I talk about Trump, and I did that because while we can argue about whether or not Trump himself is a fascist, I think he is, but and many of the world's leading scholars of fascism think he is. But that does not mean, does it, that the election of Trump now means the U.S. is per se itself a fascist nation. In fact, your party, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, it talks about how America has never been a fully democratic nation anyway, how over its existence it has steadily become less and less democratic. Indeed, the world organization that rates the world's democracies places the U.S. democracy way, way down the list, not as 100 and some. And your party points to how the ever more powerful role that is played by capitalism in America is such that to the extent that, well, we're now really pretty much ruled by a corporate capitalist oligarchy. And that also puts the lie to the notion that we can truly call ourselves, of course, a democratic nation. And so it follows that while the election of Trump does not mean that America is yet a fascist nation, it does demonstrate how over the history of our country, we have steadily become an ever more far right, more repressive nation, perhaps a truly authoritarian nation. So, Dick Becker, please talk to us about all of that.
Yes, well, there's a lot there, huh? Yeah. Really a lot there. I mean, talking about the whole history of the United States.
Yeah.
I'd like to say that, you know, the victory of Trump, this victory of Trump, it's appalling that a character like this could be elected.
Oh, my God.
It is a horrific character. There's no doubt about that. And he's proven it over and over again. And so why did he get elected? Is it because all the people who voted for him are all terrible people like him? I don't think that's a correct analysis.
No.
I'm not suggesting that you are suggesting that either. But I think that, you know, what we've seen here, what we see with the Trump administration, the incoming administration, behind it are the banks. Behind it are the big corporations, and particularly the banks. You're right. I did a piece called "The Myth of Democracy and the Rule of the Banks." They really are, you know, immensely powerful, and they tell the government what to do. It's not the other way around. That was proven back in the crisis of 2008, 2009, the big recession and what followed it. And all of that. So that is a reality of the situation that we face. I would say that the U.S. Has gone through a number of changes, profound changes at different times. There were the 1930s, when union organizing actually became legal for the first time. It really wasn't before that, and that. Uprising of the people at that time brought about Social Security and food stamps and social programs that didn't exist before. Before that, when people were, if they became disabled or sick, that was it for them. You know, their family was might die. So there was that, and then of course there was the 60s, and what was really an end to which put an end to apartheid American style, at least the legal apartheid system. And in the wake of that, brought with it the women's movement and the LGBTQ movement and the American Indian movement and the Puerto Rican independence movement and the disabled rights movement, all of which profoundly affected the U.S. And along with it brought economic programs and so forth. What Trump wants to do, what the Trump administration intends to do, is to try to roll back as much of that as possible. Those two periods of time, which brought about such profound changes, they want to get rid of those rights. That's what, and to clear the way so that there's nothing that fetters capitalist profiteering. No matter what the cause, and we should say the environment too. The environment is a target. Immigrants are a target. Some of that, as you mentioned before. So this is requires. It really does require, and will require a movement, a more powerful movement that can really fight back against this. I wanted to say, though, that, you know, when we talk about what happened, how do we assess why this happened? I would say that the way that we should assess it is that the Democratic Party utterly failed. And should first of all say that if you put together all of the votes of the progressive third party candidates, and that included Jill Stein from the Green Party, Cornel West from Justice for All Party, and Claudia de la Cruz from my party, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and not all of those boys put together affected any state. No state was affected by that. So, but there was a great deal of lack of enthusiasm for the Democrats among a large parts of the population. What has become, what was most, I think, known and obvious and organized was the No Votes for Genocide campaign and the movement, the uncommitted movement that was based in the Arab American and Islamic communities, who, because of the very fact that that the Democrats fully supported and have presided over, really, the genocide going on in Gaza, the Israeli war against that's going on against Lebanon and against other countries in the region, the delivery of tens of billions of dollars, tens of billions on top of the regular appropriation that Israel gets, tens of billions of dollars in weaponry, all those 2,000 pound and 1,000 pound bombs, they're all made in the United States. And so with the
so Richard, Richard, I want you to continue, but you're making such an important point. I want to make sure our listeners are not really missing it. What I hear you saying, correct me if I'm wrong, up till now, and you're going to go on, is that it's not simply, is it the failure of the Democratic Party, although there's certainly that. That suggests sort of a lack of action. It's also the actions that were taken by Democrats and Republicans alike in the name of capitalism and in the name of what you've talked about has been central to the demise of democracy over the years, isn't it? They haven't simply been absent in action. They've also been engaged in actions which are contrary to what you would think this country and we want this country to be.
Yeah, I mean, we have to say the blood of the people who have died in the genocide in Gaza is on the hands of the leaders of the Democratic Party. Including, of course, Biden, but, you know, now, of course, because of the current nominee and, you know, mm-hmm. or former nominee now, she's no longer the nominee. But there's also more to it than that, too. Mm-hmm. It's not just that war, it's the Ukraine war. And again, then tens of billions of dollars and really a refusal to accept negotiations in that war. So you have a lot of people are saying, why is all our money going there? And then we have other things that the Democratic Party has not done and done. What they didn't do when they had both the houses and the presidency was they didn't renew for a period of years the child the Child Assistance Act of $300 a month. You know, for a lot of people, that was the difference between, and for a lot of children, that was the difference between living in poverty and being able to get by. The child poverty, in 1 year, the child poverty rate went up from 5.2% to 12.4% after the cancellation of the Childhood Assistance Act. I mean, it was enormous. And then what was going on at the same time, cancellation of the moratorium on evictions that had been put into place during the in the pandemic. And I think one of the things that was most influential in the Democrats losing this and losing their support was inflation. I mean, so you had real wages because of inflation falling. You had millions of families losing that additional assistance for children. And all of a sudden, people were going into the store, and I don't think most of the politicians go into stores except for a photo, but I do. I go shopping. I'm sure you will go shopping. And to see the prices, it was like unbelievable. Like suddenly, hamburger was $9 a pound. You know, it seemed to have like, you know, doubled or tripled. And that went for everything. So you have these things. So, and then, and so what did the Democrats try to do? What was their strategy here? Their strategy was really to try to bring people like Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney and other, they really were trying to get George W. Bush and some of the generals. And so in other words, they're going in this direction of, like the Reagan Democrats, winning back the Reagan Democrats or something like that, to the extent that they exist anymore. Yeah. And it was a strategy that, and all in all, was a failure. It was a strategy. They failed, and they failed the people, and the people turned against them. I mean, even the popular vote, what is it, 6 million now in favor of Trump? I mean, that's, so I would say that it like Ralph Nader, I thought, had interesting commentary, which you may have heard today, where he said, you know, this is, he thinks this is the end of the Democratic Party, and that it's, you know, it's a centrist imperialist party that's moving to the right. And I think that it was proven during the campaign that their strategy was, let's move to the right. But if you're going to move to the right, you know, everyone who's interested in the right has already got their right wing candidate. So I really think that is that, like, this is a colossal failure on the part of the Democratic Party. And it's a big question of what will happen to the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Right. And so foreseeable. Can I just throw that out? Anyway, I did want to get in the question about civil rights and liberties, because I think those of us here at KPFK, you as an activist, you know, while we here in the U.S. do enjoy more freedoms than many other people in the world, throughout our nation's history, there have been times when we've famously had less rights and freedoms than in other times. So just quickly, I know we're using up our time here, but how concerned are you that Trump and his cronies running the country again, you know, where will there be even less room for engaging in meaningful protest than in the recent past? And are you concerned at all about those fighting for civil and human rights and other progressive causes? Do you think we will be seeing more and more repression and, you know, vengeance, if you will, against Trump's political enemies?
Yeah, I think that it would be naive for us to think otherwise. I think that that's clearly part of what's coming. The people who will come in the new administration don't have any concern about that. Trump himself has no concern about our rights. You know, it's interesting to just, when we talk about this, you know, we think about Kamala Harris when Kamala Harris was the DA here in Alameda County. She didn't care that much about rights either at the time. And, you know, wanting to lock up or arrest parents for truant children and that kind of thing. But this is a serious danger There's no question about that. It's a serious danger. It's going to require a highly organized movement, a conscious movement to fight back. I mean, and we very much believe that that movement can succeed. You know, it comes out of sometimes the most conservative periods that new movements are born. You know, if you had told anybody on November 30th, 1955, at the height of McCarthyism and reaction and all of that and segregation, that, you know, I think something is going to happen tomorrow in Montgomery, Alabama, that will change the world and lead to the end of apartheid American style event. You couldn't have gotten very many takers on that one. And that was the next day Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on the bus and, you know, thus commenced the Montgomery bus boycott and the civil rights movement full on. So, and I say that not to say, you know, we know something else like that's going to happen, but we actually don't know what's going to happen. There's many things that are outside of our control or Trump's control or anybody's control that very often lead to profound changes. But we have to organize ourselves. We don't know what's going to happen, but we do know that we can, what we do have some control over is what kind of organization and what kind of coalition and unity we can build in the united front in the period that's coming against what we know is coming.
Yeah, indeed. And you know, all of this too, Dick, doesn't it? It brings to mind, of course, the lesser evil argument that has so dominated American politics for so long. The notion that the best we can do is, and when faced with a Democrat and Republican, one's more liberal, one's more to our liking than the rest. Well, we don't really like them much, but gee, they're better than the other woman or the other guy. And so that's what we do. And the efforts to do something more than that, the efforts of people like yourself who understand that those two parties, one may at some points in American history be more offensive than other in terms of the rights and benefits of the people of this country, but it's not as though either of them has done what the richest country on earth should be doing for its people, whether it's rights or whether it's economic justice and the like. And that certainly was even true in the last election. How do we get beyond that? How do we get people in their, especially in their desperation, to understand that a significant break must be made from that? How do we convince enough people that a third party, called a working people's party, a socialist democratic party, that something that is avowedly not capitalistic and not simply being done for the interest of corporate America can be powerful enough, can be strong enough, and even if it takes some lumps in the short run, is better to pursue and fight for the long run, because otherwise we're never going to get out of the conundrum we're in, which at this point with Trump has really demonstrated how foul being left with only those two choices could be. And that's something I know you've been very much engaged in, not only thought-wise, but on the ground-wise for many, many years. So talk to us a bit about that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you have to, ever since I've been able to vote, my first voting election was 1968. And every time since then, it's always, you know, well, this election is different than all the others. This is an important election. And so therefore you have to vote for the lesser evil. Of course, I mean, that argument, you have to think like, well, you know, in 2000, Joe Biden was the lesser evil. And you'd have to ask the question I think you have to ask that question, not just to people in the United States, but, you know, do you think, how about the people in Gaza? Do they think Joe Biden is the lesser evil? You know, so this goes on. And as you suggested, as long as this prevails, there can never be another party. I mean, there's so many blockages to the formation of another party in the U.S. There's no parliamentary system. There's no proportional representation. There's different conditions and requirements for getting on the ballot in every single state and the District of Columbia, not for a federal election. So they made it very, very difficult anyways. And then if anybody tries to break out, which, you know, we and others are trying to do, of the system that's dominated by the two capitalist and imperialist parties, then they're condemned, and including by others on the left. You know, so the argument of the lesser evil, you know, like I said, this has been going on and on and on. But, you know, so in 1992, the lesser evil was Bill Clinton. Actually, mm-hmm. Bill Clinton never would have won if there wasn't a third party that year. If it wasn't for the Ross Perot effort,
right.
I don't think he would have won. But let's accept, you know, for a minute, the lesser evil. Well, his predecessor, George H.W. Bush, had instituted the sanctions, which are really a genocidal policy against the people of Iraq, and destroyed the infrastructure in the first Gulf War. Clinton took over as the lesser evil, maintained the sanctions for the next 8 years. In 1998, signed the Iraq Liberation Act, which made it officially the policy of the U.S. to overthrow the government. And then his successor, who came in, did overthrow the government and killed hundreds of thousands more. Who was the lesser evil then? I mean, when you look mm-hmm. back on it, who was the lesser evil? Well, I mean, the problem, you know, the real issue is the United States is the dominant world imperialist power. And the both the Democrats and Republicans are loyal to it. And there has to be a break at some point. We hope there would be a break with Bernie Sanders, that there would be a break in the Democratic Party. It would have cost an election, but how else do you get to having a party that really represents the people? Unless
exactly.
you start building that party and you work for a third party that can really become a major force in the country.
Speaking of that, and we are unfortunately running out of time, but in the last 2 minutes or so, Richard Becker, if you could just tell us, you know, your thoughts on what must the left, quote unquote, whether it be the left progressive or left socialist movements, what should we be doing in the country beyond what those parties have been doing now, if they are going to be more successful than what happened under the Biden-Harris presidency?
Well, I think that we have to organize. I mean, our view in the PSL is that we have to build a socialist party that's a real alternative, and one that is fighting for a new system and makes it clear that it's fighting for a new system. This system could provide for everyone. It could provide for everyone, but it doesn't. That's the theme that we should have, not, hey, can we get Dick Cheney in the coalition? You know? I mean, that's what we just saw happen. I mean, that's the reality. So we need to put forward a program that really represents the interests and the needs of people. And we have to be ready to fight, to carry on the struggle. You know, are they really going to try to deport 12 million immigrants? I mean, is everybody ready to stop eating? Because, you know, without immigrant labor, the entire food chain in the United States is based on immigrant labor and mostly on undocumented workers. So mm-hmm. what are they going to really do? Trump is promising mass deportation. If there's going to be mass deportation, there has to be mass resistance. There has to be resistance to all of the program that they're putting forward. But it will not succeed without us putting forward a program that really does represent and can appeal to the great majority of people who are the working class and the middle class in the United States.
And Dick, if people want to learn more about that movement, left parties, your party, other parties, where would you suggest people go to do more reading about this?
Yes. So a really great starting point is liberationnews.org. And it's one long word, liberationnews.org. You'll see material today that's commenting, you know, statements and articles on what's just happened and what's coming up. But it's continually refreshed with new material, and you can look back at the old material. But liberationnews.org is really good. And Breakthrough News is also a very, very useful site. That's Breakthrough News. And one other that I would mention is The Socialist Program with Brian Becker, which is on 3 days a week. Richard Wolff, the Marxist economist, is on generally on a weekly basis. But there's a lot of analysis and coverage that goes on there.
And Dick, perhaps in a naive hope, I hope not, I ask you, there's a part of me, and I can't say that I'm not depressed by where the American voter is at the moment, but we've been talking about why they're, it's not because there's something genetically wrong with the American people. I wonder to what extent I feel that perhaps the one thing that keeps me a bit hopeful is that perhaps I think we're in for such a shockingly, quote unquote, un-American in the true sense of what we're taught in school, that means, not in the true sense of what it has become, that there's a sense in which what we're now going to experience in the next few years is going to be so horrific, so leaving behind, indeed, the very people who voted for him, that it provides a perhaps better opening because of the starkness of it, a better opening to people like yourself and others who are offering a third way, a truly third way, if you will. Am I being naive in that regard?
You know, it is very true that sometimes it's out of the worst reaction that movements toward revolution arise. That's been true and very progressive. We mentioned, you know, I mentioned before the Rosa Parks.
Yes.
A terrible time, a really terrible time. And if you look at all the the revolutions, revolutionary movements, most of them have come out of really terrible conditions. So we don't want to be Pollyannish about it. We're not.
No.
Or naive about the danger that is faced. But we believe that, you know, this can turn into its opposite. It can turn into something that the world, the people of this country, and the people of the world really need, which is a different United States of America.
It can do that, is your point, and I would agree with that. If we do it, it's if we make it so, and I know you and others are committed to that. And this station is committed to it. Those of us on this show are committed to it, and there are happily millions and millions of people in this country that are. But Dick Becker, as always, we thank you for explaining it to us in a way we can understand, and in helping give us that hope. And putting that understanding before. So, Dick Becker, thank you very much for joining us again today here on the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Maria.
All right. We'll take a brief station ID, and then we'll be right back with you on our next guest and topic, immigration.
You're tuned into Pacifica Radio, KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.5 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest, China Lake, and streaming universally at kpfk.org. Radio powered by you, the people.
I hear our music again. It's a little hard under this setup. You're still listening to the lady, to the Lawyers Guild Show, my friends. I'm still Jim Lafferty, along with Maria Hall. And we're co-hosts of the Lawyers Guild Show. And now Maria's going to introduce our second topic of the hour, having to do with immigration. Maria, do so, please.
Yes, thanks, Jim. Well, we're now turning to the subject of immigration and how the election results may influence policy and practice in our country, and more particularly in the border states and here in Los Angeles. Over the past year, the major party candidates, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, made no secret of their views on immigration. Donald Trump riled up his supporters by demonizing immigrants and their advocates, vowing to build more walls and to deport millions of people. And for her part, Kamala Harris tried to stay more in the center by walking a tightrope, claiming she'd expand legal pathways on the one hand to citizenship, but would also make it harder to get asylum and would increase the number of immigration judges and border control agents. After all, she was a prosecutor. So one thing both of those plans have in common, well, they would be very expensive. So one thing I didn't hear much about on the mainstream news, but I was curious about, was the immigration views of other candidates for president. So I did just a little surface view, and I was kind of shocked to find that one thing that Libertarian Chase Oliver, Green Party member Jill Stein, and Independent Cornel West all had in common was their view on immigration. And specifically, it was for more open borders, the need to demilitarize the borders, and the need to stop detaining people just for being immigrants. because based on the fact that it's a violation of human rights and dignity, not to mention, as we said, exorbitantly expensive. So while none of them really had a chance of winning, it shows that maybe we can't count on Democrats or Republicans to come up with the wisest policies for the people. So with all of that in mind, what kind of changes can we expect to see in 2025 with a second Trump presidency? And what can we do to best protect our communities? To help us answer these questions, we're so grateful to have with us back on the Lawyers Guild show, Alvaro Huerta, the Director of Litigation and Advocacy at Immigrant Defenders Law Center. Alvaro was previously a senior attorney at National Immigration Law Center, also known as NILC, where for over a decade he defended and advanced the rights of low-income immigrants and their family members through litigation, advocacy, and community education. Alvaro is committed to racial justice advocacy and lawyering from a community-building perspective, so he is in the right place. Alvaro Huerta, thank you for being back with us on the Lawyers Guild show.
Thanks for having me back, Maria and Jim.
Sure. Well, a common theme, I want to start out by just making a plea to don't panic, everyone. I know we all are wanting to panic at this moment, but a common theme that I've heard from immigrant advocates is no matter what happens, don't panic, because the rumors are spread on social media. People start doing crazy things like grabbing their kids out of school and not getting food stamps and things like that. So, you know, some of that on social media is really designed to cause panic and chaos. So do you agree with that? You know, should we be kind of trying to stay calm? And if so, what can people do if they're nervous instead of panicking?
I definitely wholeheartedly agree that we shouldn't be panicking. Trump may have won last night, but the Constitution didn't go away. We still have rights in this country. We still have due process. And we have a strong immigrant rights movement, much stronger than it was 8 years ago. So we definitely want people to stay calm and educate themselves. What they can do is really educate themselves about their rights and seek community. Some people feel they're all alone right now, feel like they don't have someone to talk to about this. There are lots of people in the same situation, and you should be seeking community, whatever that is for you. You should look for that, because there will be people who have your back.
You know, Alvaro, too, I could certainly understand. I mean, I'm not in the situation of an undocumented immigrant, and it sends chills up my spine just thinking about it in terms of friends and what have you. And so I can only imagine what would go on within the immigrant community. And it's important to remember that community has fought back before in huge numbers and won many victories, by the way, and not just in the courts, but in the streets. And the other thing that I think is perhaps if it's better understood, might have somewhat of a calming effect, I wanted to ask you about this is, legally, and I understand Trump talks about being an authoritarian and dictator and all that kind of stuff, but legally, federal government can't force the local sheriff's department and police departments to do something different than they're doing around immigration. Now, the threat of withholding government money can certainly have some influences and what have you. But in a place here in California, for example, those kinds of threats might be rather hollow. In addition, you talk about money. I read somewhere this morning that to actually do what Trump talks about doing, the number of personnel that would be involved, the holding camps, the new judges, the enforcement, we're talking about over $900 billion, over $900 billion. You know, and so forth and so on. And so in that regard, isn't it fair to say that there are certain limitations, not just practical like money, but also legal, that are going to stand in the way of Trump doing, you alluded to this, that are going to stand in the way of Trump doing what he claims he wants to do, what he has, quote unquote, promised the American people he will do?
Certainly. I think we should take Trump at his word, though. I think he is going
to
try.
He wants to. He wants to.
Yeah. Exactly. He's gonna try to throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. He's going to, unfortunately, get some cooperation in places like Texas and other places in the South. Like you said, Jim, we're very lucky in California that we have laws on the books that will prevent cooperation between state and local law enforcement and the federal government when it comes to immigration enforcement. We have to hold our government officials accountable to those too, right? Because we know that there are places, even in California, where we will have some sheriffs, we will have some police chiefs who want to help Trump accomplish some of these goals. But we should fight back. And we do have, and like you said, it's true that all of these policies are incredibly cruel and inhumane. And part of the what he's trying to do is make a cruel system, make it very hard for immigrants to want to stay in this country. But like you said, it's impractical. This would cost an extraordinary amount of money, extraordinary amount of personnel. And not only is it impractical, it's illegal in lots of ways, right? We still have due process in this country. Even if someone has a removal order, they still get to go before an immigration judge to potentially fight that removal order. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to assist them to do that.
So we want immigrants not to be packing up and leaving, as you said before, but to, you know, painting up those protest signs and getting ready to help be part of that fight.
Exactly. We know that we have some of the laws that are on our side. We know that the Trump administration is still going to try to get away with as much as they can. Hopefully we'll have courageous judges that really stand up for the Constitution and stand up for all of our civil rights. Oftentimes what we forget is that when we take away civil rights from immigrants, that eventually will come back to haunt us too. When we don't protect the rights of the least among us, that will come back to haunt us. So we need people to stand up. We need judges to really push back. And we did actually see that during the last Trump administration, right? Even conservative judges, they were bound by the Constitution and they did stand up. So we hope to see that as well. But you're right, Jim, it will take people getting out in the streets to backing immigrants up as well. And immigrants themselves, of course. We want immigrants leading this movement because they should be at the forefront.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about California a little bit. You alluded to it as, you know, having special rules to protect immigrants. And, you know, it is officially a quote unquote sanctuary state. Can you explain what sanctuary status means? What are some of the extra protections that immigrants have in California?
Sure. So in California, we're very lucky that two laws passed, the California Values Act and the California Trust Act, over the last few years, recent years, many in response to the last Trump administration. But what it effectively means is that California is not going to spend money to cooperate with the federal government on immigration enforcement and will also prevent the sharing of information, for example, with the federal government. About immigrants and their status, and will not, in many cases, transfer immigrants to the custody of the federal authorities in order to carry out enforcement activities. We still have a lot to do that we could, you know, to buttress those rights that we have here and to protect immigrant communities. But we are very lucky and fortunate that in California we've decided on a completely different approach. That's inclusive of immigrants, that recognizes the contribution of immigrants and then make sure that they can stay here with their families and in their communities.
Yeah, you know, and that is so true. I mean, that's not true, sadly, of every state, but there are different cities in California. In fact, I wondered about this, and Maria, in doing the main preparation for this particular interview, pointed out to me again that there is a certain amount of confusion, is there not, right here in Los Angeles, about exactly what Los Angeles status is. I mean, I think of it, it's often spoken of as though it's a sanctuary city, but is it really? Is it technically done that? Has the city council actually ever said so? Talk to us about that and what, if anything, more should be done, or what our listeners and what immigrants should be pressing this city to do to make sure that sense of what Los Angeles is really is what it says to be or wants to be.
That's exactly right. We definitely are a welcoming city and a sanctuary city in name, at least. We definitely have policies in place that will keep our immigrant community safe. But we do need to put pen to paper and get a sanctuary ordinance actually written down and passed by the city council. And that is before the council now. They voted, I believe late last year or earlier this year, to write a sanctuary ordinance, but we haven't seen that language yet. So we need to continue to put pressure on the city council in order for them to do that. And in fact, this Friday, they will be having a hearing on Jim McDonald's appointment to be chief of police. What we know is that, unfortunately, Jim McDonald has actually expressed support for anti-immigrant policies in the past.
That's
He
right.
said that he's going to follow whatever the city council does and our policies when it comes to immigrants. So that's exactly why we need the city council to put that sanctuary ordinance down on paper and to pass it immediately. And there's actually, so this Friday at 12 o'clock, there will be a hearing where we can provide public comment and ask the city council to do exactly that.
And are you and others and other leaders in the immigrant rights movement and people going to be there to make their voices heard on that? Can our
Yes.
listeners join
And
that? How might they find out more about that?
yeah, we welcome folks to join a rally that's happening at 11 o'clock at City Hall, and then to join us at noon at the City Council chambers to provide public comment.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for letting us know about that. And speaking of LA as a welcoming city for immigrants, the last time you joined us back in April, we were talking about the busloads of migrant families that were being bused to California, Los Angeles, from Texas by governor at the orders of Governor Abbott. And there were really heroic efforts that you were describing about, people welcoming the families and providing help to them. What's the status on that? What's been happening? Are busloads still coming? Did they stop? What's the latest?
So fortunately, and we know that was a political stunt by the Texas governor to kind of bring this, pressure onto places that cities that call themselves sanctuary cities. Fortunately, we haven't seen a bus since about January of this year, so it's been quite a while. That doesn't mean it won't happen. That doesn't mean we won't see buses come in the future, but we do have an infrastructure in place to welcome those folks. They might see it as a political stunt. We see it as an opportunity to show that Los Angeles is a place where we welcome immigrants. We're gonna take them in. We're gonna find them the support they need, and be inclusive of them and serve as a model for other places to do the same.
And there's still a lot of unknown here. There's unknown about what the Trump administration is really going to do, how quickly it's really going to do. Everything he's going to do on day one, it's going to be a 8,000-hour day, I guess. But he's going to be busy on day one. But we, in fairness, we don't know quite what's going to happen come January 21st. But one thing is, I think for sure, the Immigrant Defenders Law Center. And other like-minded groups are certainly going to be more important than ever and busier than ever, I fear. And so what are immigrant defenders' priorities at this point going forward into 2025? I mean, I suspect there's been some thought and work done on this before the election was even held. If Trump wins or if Harris wins, what are we going to need to prepare ourselves for? Can you give us a sense of what some of that planning might have consisted of, or where you see the main focus or needs going ahead.
You're exactly right. We've been preparing for this possibility for months now. And like you said, we were preparing for a Harris administration as well. We've seen that the Harris administration was also doing, and the Biden administration, I should say, the Biden-Harris administration put in place some really terrible policies that actually laid the groundwork for a new Trump administration to take advantage of, right? Closing down our borders, effectively shutting down our asylum system. So we've been planning for whatever was going to happen, come January and come these elections. Between now and then, we are going to push the Biden administration to do whatever it can to protect those folks who are currently in the system right now, right? We're going to ask for prosecutorial discretion. We're going to ask them to provide work permits to those who are eligible for them. We're going to ask them to make sure that temporary protected status is available to those who are can get it, and that it's extended for those populations that don't yet that have it, and hopefully implemented for those that don't. We need to make it hard for the Trump administration to undo some of these things. And I think there's still an important role for the Biden administration to make the situation better before the Trump administration starts. And like I said before, we do have to take the Trump administration at their word that they will try many of these things, as impractical, as illegal as they are. We hope to do whatever you can to gum up, what they're trying to do in courts, to get the word out to community members about their rights, to ensure that they have a plan in place in case there are massive worksite raids, for example, in case there are people being picked up on the streets. Again, we don't want people to panic. We just want people to be prepared instead. And so it's important for them to have that information and feel empowered with that information that if something terrible does happen, they have a plan in place to react and to take action. We do expect that they're going to try to shut the border down even more, take advantage of programs that they used in the past, like the migrant protection protocols, also known as Remain in Mexico, that they'll use an excuse to use something like Title 42, which kept people out during the COVID pandemic. We expect them to do all sorts of crazy things to attack. You know, they pretend that they're doing all of these things to keep undocumented immigrants out, but we know that their ultimate goal is to keep all immigrants out, those who have a pathway or not. They're going to limit the pathways. They're going to rescind a lot of the lawful pathways that the Biden administration put in place, so we're expecting that to happen. And we're hoping to be able to fight back. We plan to fight back against all of that as well. And then we're going to do what we can to do locally, right? Again, like I said, we want to make LA a model place for immigrants, a welcoming city, so that other cities who feel the same way can take that similar approach. There's more to do on the state level as well to ensure that, for example, immigrants who are currently in removal proceedings or who will find themselves in deportation proceedings will have a lawyer. Unfortunately, not every immigrant can afford a lawyer, and we don't provide one at the state or federal cost. So we can ask California to stand up for immigrants, provide a lawyer for everybody in that situation. We're also hoping to work with the state attorney general, right? The state attorneys general played a huge role during the first Trump administration to fight back not only on a lot of anti-immigrant policies that they put in place, but all types of policies, right? The state attorneys general were really important players in that, and we hope to coordinate with them to ensure that there is someone standing up for California residents and residents in other states as well.
Wow. Well, that is, and we are having some flashbacks back to 2017, and there has been so much learned, I think, from that time. And if we remember just the hundreds of volunteers coming to LAX and the airport when Trump initiated that so-called Muslim ban, there was really a groundswell of people, community members, lawyers coming to volunteer. So I know that that overwhelmed the people who were actually doing the work before that, you all and some other organizations, because everyone wanted to volunteer, but maybe they weren't trained in immigration law or didn't speak Spanish or didn't speak other languages. So what kind of, if listeners are inspired to do something, what do you suggest how can they plug in? How can they find out what's happening? You mentioned the city hall, the hearing next Friday, but what else are there? What are good sources of information for people to get active and be part of creating Los Angeles as this model community?
And I do hope that people will, right? We do need people to stand up. I think, unfortunately, as Trump is threatening mass deportations, we may see the return of family separations. There's going to be things that I hope will really drive people to come out on the streets, because if we don't show a resistance, then they're going to get away with a lot, right? And we know that, unfortunately, the mood has changed on immigration, at least on the national level, in lots of ways. We have to be honest about that and reckon with that. But we need people to stand up when some of these terrible policies are put in place, and to the extent that they're allowed to happen by the courts and even the Supreme Court, we have to fight back. People can get information by following IMDEF on our social media, following other organizations that are local, like the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights, CARESEN, Public Counsel, the California Immigrant Policy Center. These are all organizations that have stepped up and will continue to step up and fight back. So follow these organizations on social media. Sign up for listservs and email newsletters so that you can be informed about ways to get involved. You can find all of those organizations with a Google search or your search engine of choice. And yes, just be informed, get the information, and then, you know, we'll be sure, we're going to make sure that people have action that they can take. So look out for those, because we do need people on the streets. We do need people contacting their local and state government officials. We do need people telling our Congress members and our senators to step up as well, right?
Well, look at the success. Look at the success back in 17 or whatever it was, when a million people, a million immigrants and their friends and supporters here in Los Angeles put the nails in the coffin of the, it was the Sensenbrenner Act, I remember back at that time. It can be done. It's such a powerful movement when it puts its mind to it, as it has so often with many victories. And remind our listeners, before we do have to let you go, where do they learn more about the Immigrant Defenders Law Center? What is your website address and that sort of thing?
Sure. So www.imdef.org, short for Immigrant Defenders, imdef.
Okay.
.org. You can sign up for email, our email newsletter there, and get more information, learn about the programs that we have, the issues that we're going to be focusing on. These other organizations as well. We're very lucky that we do have a very strong immigrants' rights movement here in Los Angeles. There are lots of organizations. And like I said, you're not alone. We have community. We have places for people to fight back, resist. That's what we need to do in the next 4 years. We know we've been here before, we survived, and we're going to continue to fight. That's exactly what we need to do over the next 4 years.
And happily, we have you. I mean that, Alvaro Huerta, and your organization, and as you say, many, many others. So we thank you for bringing that message to us today. We'll keep repeating it here off and on as time goes on in this fight. This station is part of that movement. This program wants to always be a part of that movement. We thank you for the amazing work you've done. And we do want you to know, and I'm sure you do know, as you've said, that there are so many people in this town who care so deeply about our immigrant sisters and brothers, that it isn't just those of you working in the trenches on a day-to-day basis that will have to do this fight. You're going to have a lot of support. And they aren't going to simply walk into LA and have their way. So don't pack up, friends. Immigrants, says, don't pack up. Stay put. Join the fight. We can win. Thank you so much, Alvaro, for being with us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim Maria.
Maria, I guess that's it. I haven't heard our theme music yet. Is it playing? It's always hard for me to hear it here.
I know. It'll be playing momentarily.
Okay. Well, we'll be back with you next week, folks. If it does start playing, we'll be back with you next week, same time, same place. And we're going to continue, obviously, to keep a sharp eye on the plans of the new Trump administration and the ongoing problems with the current administration, as we bring you stories and fights that you want to be a part of and need to know about. So until then, on behalf of Maria Hall, myself, Jim Lafferty, thanks for listening today. Stay healthy and happy, my friends. Stay healthy. We're going to need you. Until next week, same time, make sure you continue standing up for your rights. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an odd that Peter's gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your rights. Come on. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Most people think great God.
Hi, I'm Andrew Tonkovich, host of Bibliocracy Radio. Heard here on KPFK every Tuesday afternoon at 2 p.m. Each week I share my conversations with authors of books I admire, cultural workers who promote reading, writing, and civic literacy. Whether fiction, nonfiction, memoir, poetry, or criticism, I engage writers whose work reflects, challenges, and interprets our collective experience. Please listen along and read along in a weekly celebration of the two most elegant expressions of democratic engagement and the activist imaginary ever invented, reading and radio, on our community radio station, KPFK, every Tuesday afternoon at 2 p.m. on Bibliocracy. The ink is black, the page is white.
Hey now, this is Steve Whalen. Join me Sundays from 8 to 10 p.m. for Primal Dead, a weekly snapshot from the expansive world of the Grateful Dead. That's Primal Dead, your home for Grateful Dead music, only on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and online for the world at kpfk.org.